The whole idea of judgment, which I believe in, nevertheless is used so viciously in Christian history, you know. Tip one's hat to it as one passes by, you know, but basically it's not our business.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, you're listening to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. And I'm delighted to say that this week's guest on The Profile is Marilyn Robinson. Marilyn is the author of a number of critically acclaimed novels, including Jack, Home, Housekeeping, and perhaps most prominently, Gilead, for which she was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Marilyn's latest work is entitled Reading Genesis, a work of nonfiction which sees her analyze the text not from an academic or literalist standpoint, but as someone interested in stories. And it's been praised by the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, as a work of exceptional wisdom and imagination. The Atlantic, meanwhile, described Robinson in their review as one of the greatest living Christian novelists. Marilyn Robinson, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
I wanted to talk plenty about your latest book. As I mentioned, it's called Reading Genesis. I want to start by asking you, who is this book for and what are you hoping to achieve with it?
Well, the book is basically myself following through certain questions or certain observations that I had about a book that I have read or taught many times. Never to my own satisfaction, because it seemed to me as if it were not understood in the terms that it invited. And so, you know, it was a lot of my books are really myself wondering about something, you know. I can't really maintain the idea of an audience very well. It seems kind of, you know, an artificial concept.
You say not understood in the terms it should be. Can you speak more to that? What is it about Genesis that we're perhaps not reading in the right way?
Well, you know, it's full of recurrent subjects that go on through Torah and through, you know, the prophets and so on, and the New Testament. These, you know, the recurrences, like the pattern of forgiveness, it recurs so intensely in Genesis and seems almost never to be noticed, oddly enough, you know. The paralleling, for example, of figures like Hagar and Abraham, which is a very striking feature of the text and also very little noticed. In my experience, seeing what people say about these things. It's an odd thing to be offering what looks like perhaps a novel interpretation of a book that's been interpreted for thousands of years. I have to laugh, but at the same time, it seems to me as if that's that is what needs to be done, because conventional interpretations of Genesis minimize the text, and also I think are rather disparaging of what is called the Old Testament God, you know. Both of these things seem to me to be very important errors from the point of view of anyone who takes the Bible seriously.
Yes, absolutely. I think especially, you know, Christians having long understood it's one God, the same God of the Old Testament and the New Testament. And you're right, I think a lot of other people outside of the Christian faith have tended to portray the Old Testament as this kind of angry God that's somehow different to what we find in the New Testament.
Yes, I think that's very characteristic. It's actually rare to find real exceptions, I think.
Most books written about Genesis would typically be written perhaps by a theologian or a philosopher. You're not doing that, are you? You're coming at it as a novelist. You're looking at it through the lens of story. And of course, Genesis is full of stories. What are you hoping a Christian might do differently in terms of their engagement with Genesis as a result of seeing the book through your eyes and engaging with your work?
People are sort of on their own. We all are, you know. You see what you see in a text, you know. I hope that I've complicated the way in which it's read and enriched the way it's read too, because I think that in a special degree, the reading of the text has been impoverished by the scholarly traditions that surround it. I allude to the documentary hypothesis in the book, I think, once or twice. But basically, what that hypothesis is an assertion that the text is not intrinsically meaningful. And that's a terrible that's a terrible beginning for any serious attempt to give anything its due, you know.
How important is it for you to deal with that question of, was there a real first literal man named Adam and woman called Eve? Is that a question you have any interest in engaging, and do you take a view on a question like that?
We know that the figure of Adam and Eve, the figures of Adam and Eve, are used to assert the likeness of human beings to God, you know. And it seems to me as if that's the important thing to conclude from the mention of them and the fact of, you know, Adam delved and Eve span, you know, they are about what are imagined as human beings living in the world that we imagine as having its thistles and thorns. We don't imagine it, we know it. I can't imagine what literalism would even mean in the context of the dewy morning of first creation, you know. I think that it's that questions like that obscure the real substance of what is being discussed. I find that there's entirely too little interest really in the conception of human beings as images of God, what that would mean. And so that's how I feel about those things. I don't, you know, when you think about like the physics of beginning, you know, which the affinity between contemporary science and Genesis is pretty uncanny. But you know that you're looking back into something utterly amazing and outside the reach of human understanding. And that's fine with me.
I've noticed in a lot of the interviews you've given, quite aside from this book, reading Genesis, this idea of we are created in God's image is a concept that I think is very meaningful to you, that you it comes up a lot in the conversations you have. And I'd love to hear you speak a bit more to that, you know, this, because I think sometimes for Christians, we're so used to hearing that in a church context of, oh, yes, we're made in the image of God. It's worth pausing and thinking, what does that actually mean? How would that change the way I live if I really took time to understand that? And of course, it is a term that's been debated through the centuries by theologians. What does this even mean that we're created in the image of God? What's your view on that?
Well, you know, I'm a Calvinist. I admire his metaphysics. I'm not a 17th century or 16th century Calvinist, but nevertheless, he begins the Institutes by talking about the beautiful detail of our existence. I mean, he talks about toenails, I think, but he also talks about the fact that we can solve problems in our sleep, that, you know, that we can imagine things that have never existed, that all that sort of thing. And I think that the, you know, the potency of human capacity for creating and perceiving and recreating and all the rest, I think that that has a great deal to do with our being images of God, and a great deal to do with our obligations to respect that knowledge if we subscribe to it.
One of the outworkings is how we treat other human beings. If we truly believe that every person we meet is made in the image of God, how can you not treat that person with respect? In your experience of church and being a Christian, how positive or negative has your experience been of other Christians and the way we collectively as Christians do that and treat other people with that dignity, which we're clearly called to do?
Well, you know, in my own experience, I think that a sort of respectful and benign, you know, expression of Christianity was typical. And I think now it is almost forgotten as a trait of Christian culture. I think that that's a terribly serious decline. Other people outside, you know, People who declare themselves to be Christian are always accusing other people of being dekind and decadent, but I think the word probably applies more appropriately to a great many of them.
Are there any particular examples you're thinking of when you say that?
Well, we have, our gun lobby, for example. We have lots of people that go around waving crosses and standing in the way of what is civilized and humane and, as I ever understood the word, Christian.
I mean, the gun lobby, as you say, is a distinctive feature, let's say, of some parts of American Christianity, for sure. I suppose it's slightly different for us in a UK context. It's very different. And that is actually an area, I think, where UK and US Christians will often clash. Because I think for the average person here in the UK, we don't really comprehend or understand the kind of the fascination or sometimes the obsession with guns. And you're saying from a theological point of view, that's right, that we shouldn't understand that, that actually understanding we're made in the image of God and we're called to love others would suggest that an obsession with guns, it doesn't fit in that picture for you. But of course, that does put you at odds with an awful lot of other Christians in America, who, if I was having this conversation with them, they'd be able to justify it theologically, wouldn't they?
No. I think they have knocked quite a few corners off Christian orthodoxy in order to accommodate their gun enthusiasm. A lot of people like me, for example, grew up with the idea that you simply respected other people's religion. You didn't, you avoided criticism of it to the furthest extent possible, but that means that people with that kind of background seem to be defenseless over against aggressive forms of what calls itself Christianity.
So some people want to draw a distinction between kind of a culturally Christian and, I suppose, a more, I'm struggling for the right term, but more real, living, breathing faith. You know, there's a difference between a sort of general assent to, yes, there's a God, to then that actually dominating the way you live and saying this God has demands of me and I must live my life in a particular way. Is that part of what's going on in the US when people talk about secularization, that actually it's those who are perhaps a little bit more nominal and no longer signing up, and it's sometimes the more radical forms that are coming to the foreground?
Yes, it's an odd dynamic. There are very good people, excellent people, exactly the kind of people you would accept, you would expect to find thinking metaphysically, perhaps, and so on, but they have, in an amazing degree, they've accepted Christianity as being what the brutalists say it is, they will not associate with it because they hate guns, because they hate slander, antagonism directed toward vulnerable people, because, for a thousand reasons. And that means that the people that naturally would incline toward religion are driven away from it by the very repulsive character that it's been given by many people in that movement.
We're speaking in an election year, of course, where the majority of people who would tick a box to say I'm an evangelical Christian are expected to vote for Donald Trump. I'm guessing, based on what you've said so far, you won't be one of those Christians.
Farthest thing from possible. The most absolutely unlikely thing that could ever happen, at least within my mortal competence.
It's interesting because I think so much of your work, and you've been really praised for your work in through painting such vivid characters, for helping us have a deeper understanding. I mean, Gilead in particular, I've seen praised, people who would not call themselves Christians in any way saying, wow, I've just really connected with these characters and I can see how faith influences their life, and people being quite moved emotionally by this as a really positive portrayal of what Christian faith can look like, that I suppose does, for a lot of people, stand in stark contrast to the political scene that you're describing, which can come across as angry and divisive. How do you respond to that? Is that something you, I don't know how deliberate that was, are you pleased with that kind of feedback to hear that there's something in your writing that presents another way of living Christianly that is perhaps very different to what is often painted in parts of the media?
Well, it isn't painted in parts of the media. It's intentional campaign on the side of people that want to defend guns and so on. That's what it is. I have been interested in religion as long as I can remember. And that's another, it's, you know, as with the book on Genesis, I explore things in my mind. Why would I consider certain behavior beautiful, for example, when, you know, things that surround it in the culture would not necessarily encourage that view and so on. So I don't really think of, I think of myself as exploring my own sense of reality rather than as being in any kind of confrontational relationship with other people. I don't have any common vocabulary with great many of them.
Did you always want to be a writer?
I believe I did always want to be a writer. I think that might be true. I had really no conception of what that was. I mean, if you saw the word Dickens on the back of a book, you sort of knew what to expect. But the fact that there was a human being named Dickens who wrote the book, that was a little bit outside my range when I started reading him. But I started writing when I was, you know what I mean? I was writing like little poems and so on from a very early age, uniformly terrible and continue to be terrible until I was old enough to decide that prose was probably my best choice. But anyway, it's a, you know, I had a brother, my brother's very interesting to me because he grew up close in age and close in, you know, life and biographies and attributes and so on, but he was always painting and drawing, you know, and I was always writing bad poems. And it was like, you know, he would get twitchy if he couldn't be drawing anything, something, you know. And I was always sitting around thinking about words. It was like predestination. Joking.
Well, you don't have to be joking. I mean, you've already mentioned that you've got a great love of Calvin. He was well known for his teaching on predestination.
Yeah, but that's basically polemical. I mean, you know, Thomas Aquinas believed in predestination. It's not.
Yes, and it's there in the scriptures as well. It's right there in Ephesians, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Yes, it is, and no, it isn't, because the problem is always that all of these people who, you know, try to deal with predestination, they're all great moralists and ethicists and never say you can't do anything about your spiritual circumstance. You know, none of them would take that position. So they are over centuries living with a contradiction. But I think it's quite clear what side they would come down on if they had to choose.
You say you're joking about God predestining you to be a writer, but is there any theological sense in which you would say, in all seriousness, you know, I think God has predestined me to follow him, for example, or any other sense in which you would be comfortable using that term?
I don't think there's any way in which I could feel comfortable with it, partly because it seems to me that the idea is rooted in an understandable but nevertheless primitive notion of time, you know, as if we were locked into a sort of determinist pattern of if this, then that, you know. And frankly, contemporary physics doesn't allow that anymore. There's enormously more play in any describable cause and effect or anything than people had thought over previous millennia, you know. I think they were making the best sense they could out of a bad idea, and a perfectly understandable idea given what was known about reality, you know, about how things work.
Can you just unpack that a little bit more for those who may not be as well read in physics as you are? So you say that when people were writing about this idea of predestination, they had this idea of time as being cause and effect, linear from one thing to another. Are you suggesting that there is now another understanding of time that supersedes that, and what exactly would that be?
Well, I'm using time as if it meant causality, you know. And so that if you knew what was happening in one moment, you could project forward. If you actually knew what, you know, you could project forward from a certain knowledge of any present time. But it turns out that there's a great deal of play in reality, that that there's, you know, a vast range of possibility under all circumstances, and then the decoherence of possibility, as they call it, or probability, that occurs, that we simply can say occurs, you know, and we can also say that normally speaking, it doesn't occur in forms that startle our sense of what is to be expected, which sort of implies, you know, it, you know, implies the faithfulness of God, I would say, you know, that he creates continuously in ways that are free in theory, but determined by his loyalty to our creation. You know, in other words, God is free, which I think is an important concept.
God does what he likes.
No, God has accepted a covenant relationship with human beings that allows him to exercise restraint, shall we say, and also providence, you know.
I'd love to come back to your early story a little bit. I understand you were raised Presbyterian. Can you tell me a little bit more about your early childhood and where the Christian faith first came in the picture for you?
Well, you know, I grew up in small towns in northern Idaho, just 40 or 50 miles out of the Canadian border, where we never went to Canada. you know, it was a kind of a, I mean, it was a town that had a frontier feeling about it. It was a lumber town. At Sandpoint, I'm talking about, or Coeur d'Alene, the other one. At that time, it was, I mean, I received a very, very traditional education, lots of Latin, you know, which was simply a result of the fact that the news had not arrived that people weren't taught Latin anymore, you know. So, I mean, it's been a great benefit to me, and maybe I should call that predestination also. I'll stop joking about that at any moment. But in any case, there are, in the mountains, and I think this is true all over the world, there tend to be people with extreme versions of other religions, typically, you know. That was true there. You know, there were about, you know, what, maybe one church for every 1,000 people at the outside. And they, you know, I mean, we sort of, my parents, my mother was Presbyterian by ancestry, gravitated toward Presbyterianism in terms of its style and its, you know, its boundaries, one might say. My grandfather was very Presbyterian, and his aura kind of suffused the family more than any kind of explicit teaching did, you know. Just that sort of thing.
And has Christian faith just always been there since those early years, or do you look back and think there was a particular moment or moments in your life where it became your own, or it changed in some way?
The more I understood about it, you know, I mean, it is a very beautiful tradition, you know, and, you know, granting difficult passages in, but nevertheless, the more you, I mean, one of the things that I really like about Christianity and theology is that every time you read a new theologian, every time you read a great theologian, you feel as though you're being told something you've never heard before. And it doesn't matter how widely you've read, you know, and, it's always that a very extraordinary, refreshing, you know. So I've just, I mean, it's a great pleasure to me as a writer to read theology. I've just been led forward by pleasure in it.
I've often thought how amazing it is that the core message of Christianity can be understood by a child. And yet at the same time, as you grow, as you get older, as you read more, you can never plumb the depths of theology of scripture. With that in mind, should we expect a follow-up to reading Genesis? Will there be a reading Exodus, a reading Leviticus, a reading Matthew, a reading Romans? Could this be a series where you go all the way through?
No. I mean, I'm 80, you know, I'm a realist. Even predestination has a terminating date, I think. But I am reading I'm writing a book on Exodus now. And I anticipate, it depends on how long I dwell on Exodus itself, but I anticipate looking at the major laws in the other books also, because they, well, you know, they're attributed to Moses also. And I think all these books are interpreting one another, not a controversial view.
So there is more on the way, but not the whole canon, because you're a realist.
Yes, I'm a realist. It's if I'd started with Matthew, you know, everything would be different, I suppose. But, you know, I'm very pleased to have being able really to reintroduce the Bible into conversation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's always interested me about my own career, which is based on the fact that I write about what I'm interested in, you know, and I could have been totally unnoticed and unperturbed by the fact, because what I want to do is pursue my interests. But the effect of my writing has been to test over and over again the assumption that many people have, that there is an impenetrable dismissiveness toward religion, that there is hostility toward Christianity. Absolutely not my experience at all. And I think that one of the things that can offend other people about people that call themselves Christian is that they're in this kind of defensive crouch, and they're always acting like somebody else is going to be unfair and antagonistic and so on. That's a very bad look, you know? I mean, that's a bad impression to make. And it is so remote from my experience.
It's fascinating you say that, because it makes total sense to me, in that you are someone who has quite literally been awarded some of the highest prizes and awards in the world of literature, and arguably almost all of your work has a pretty obvious religious and Christian message behind it, you know, both in the foreground and the background. Christianity is so present and evident in your work, and it's clearly not held back your career in any way, shape or form.
I think that's fair to say. I have tested people's generosity, and I have found that they are very generous.
But you're absolutely right to make the observation that a lot of Christians, they do have this defensive posture to the rest of the world, and sort of think the rest of the world is out to get me or disagrees with me. So where do you think that comes from? Because I think you're right, it's very widespread, and yet you are clearly someone who proves it doesn't have to be that way.
I suppose it comes out of things like class conflict, maybe, you know. There is, I mean, it's overgeneralizing, but there is a in America, a certain division in terms of education, you know, the kind of life experience one has. I mean, one of the things that's so amazing about the kind of churches that I deplore is that they tend to be very, very wealthy, you know. It's hard to talk about. I don't still feel at ease being categorically critical about anybody's religion. And I know that there are instances of great generosity and so on that could be pointed to, but then that doesn't make them unlike other people. It makes them like other people, at least to that extent, you know. I think that maybe there's a kind of conception of personal heroism involved in thinking that you're doing something that might, you know, recoil against you or something. And that's not a legitimate religious posture.
if I were to think about some of those Christians you're referencing and what they might say in response, they might point to some of those verses in the New Testament where Jesus tells his disciples that you will be hated. And there's a sense in which I think for a lot of Christians, they would say, well, you know, we do believe some contentious stuff. Like, you know, there was a real God man named Jesus who literally rose from the dead, and judgment is real. You know, these are unpalatable in certainly in plenty parts of both of our nations. So there are elements to Christian faith. They are challenging for people, and they are contentious and controversial. Would you agree?
Well, I think that for one thing, if they're aesthetically presented as they have been historically, you know, the beauty of the concepts of Christianity have been painted. It's been painted and built and sung and all the rest of it. And one does not find beauty as being an attribute of people who, you know, who claim to dwell in a hostile relationship toward the world so that they're not giving it anything beautiful, you know. There's also the fact, you know, the question how to read, you know, when Jesus says, you know, you will be hated, he's talking to people who were going to be hated for the next several centuries, you know, people who are going to be crucified and burned and all the rest of it. So, you know, you have to, he's talking to his friends, you know, I mean, and they will go off to their various painful fates. But we are not people that are disciples of Christ in that same sense, you know, and it's mean-spirited to act as if, you know, President so-and-so is going to act toward us the way Nero acted toward them. I mean, it's just dishonest.
One could think of places around the world where Christians really are persecuted right now. Mm-hmm. And by that metric, it's very hard to make an argument that Christians in the UK or the US are persecuted. If you're going to apply that word to parts of Africa, certainly China, North Korea, you know, it's not the same thing, is it?
No, it's not the same thing. And we always have to remember, even if we would rather not, that Christians have done a great deal of persecuting themselves, you know, very often of other Christians. But nevertheless, it's not as Christians that we are persecuted or that we persecute. It is, you know, it is on the moral range of our own activity that these things happen. And I mean, people that are, you know, the grand inquisitors of history have always felt they were very pious men, so far as we can tell. So we have to be very careful around the subject of who's persecuting whom.
Yes, which brings us quite neatly back to Reformed theology and Calvin. We've talked plenty about predestination and Calvinism already, but I did want to ask you specifically on your interest in John Calvin, which I think is where some of this kind of begins. If you could take us back, what first attracted you to that figure from history, and what impact has all of your studies on John Calvin and, you know, had on you? Because I don't know how much of that informed your decision that you moved from being a Presbyterian to now being part of a Reformed church, as I understand it. So can you speak more to that interest in Calvin and how that's affected your life?
Well, you know, I was Presbyterianism, at least in the United States, is utterly cheek and jowl with Congregationalism. So it's not as if I made a quantum leap of some kind or something.
Sure, know? Sure, yeah.
But, the farther I like Congregationalism because it's very democratic. I think it's short of Quakerism or something. It's the most democratic tradition. And I like a sermon. But in any case, I heard the name Calvin all the time. You do, you know, you're reading American history and so on. And then it occurred to me at a certain point that this was obviously a very, very influential body of thought, of which I knew nothing. And I'm basically an Americanist, you know. I mean, you know, you read Moby Dick and it is theology, you know. And I thought, I don't know what tradition it is that he's reacting to, you know, positively or negatively. So I taught a seminar, probably the first of its kind, where I taught Moby Dick and Calvin's Institute side by side. where Melville might be taking off from this concept to that concept, whether the sort of giantism of his humanist view of humankind and so on is Calvinist and so on. And frankly, I confirmed my own suspicions that it was. But the incredible importance of perception, the idea that what you perceive is in effect an articulation that is made toward you from God, that's Calvinism, and you find that in Thoreau and Dickinson and certainly Melville and many of the great early writers. So anyway, it was as if Herman Melville and Emily Dickinson took me by the hand and said, this is Calvinism as it has lived in our thoughts, our moral system, our imagination, and so on. And I think they're very great interpreters. And they look at very great darkness too. And it's not as if they were, it's, there's no condescension in that culture.
How would you say your own theology has changed over time?
Well, I think probably I've become more universalist. I can't, I mean, you accept, as a Christian, you accept that there are certain boundaries, beyond which God's compassion seems not to reach, which makes me laugh when I think about it now, because I did take it seriously for a while. But I don't, I, whenever I think, I mean, you know, I would not, it, I would not do any harm to any creature that exists on the planet, I'm perfectly willing to enjoy their art and enjoy their, whatever their pleasures and customs are. And I think, am I assuming that I am more generous than God? Isn't that a huge assumption? Ought one not surrender that to the category of not possible, I assume God loves all the children of Adam. I'm content with that. That's where I, I can't, I feel as if another construction might insult God. And that's something I would be happier to avoid doing,
Obviously, this has been a point of dialogue down the ages amongst Christians of, who is saved, heaven and hell. These are huge subjects. Nevertheless, if I were to speak broadly for certainly most denominations, most churches I'm aware of in this country, and ask some of those hard theological questions, I think a kind of universalism where ultimately everyone is saved is not the prominent default position of most churches that I'm aware of. So it's quite. So how far are you kind of pushing this, if I could put it that way? Are you totally kind of convinced that no, ultimately everyone will be saved? Or is it just because there's a softer version of it, isn't there? There's a softer version of it which sort of says, well, I would really hope, given that God is love and God is compassion, I would really hope his love and his grace might extend, but I kind of can't say for sure based on the scriptures and based on historical church teaching. But there's others who say, no, I think ultimately everyone's going to be okay. Can you help me with that in terms of where you're falling on that scale, if that's possible to answer?
It's like when people ask me about heaven, I have no conception of heaven. I simply trust that the word corresponds to a reality, I think that I can't be in the position of judging the ultimate intentions of God. I think that is, as they say, above my pay grade, So I don't really, all I can say is that what Christianity implies to me in that context is an appropriate humility.
There's a lot we don't know or aren't told, I suppose.
Very true.
Nevertheless, I think a lot of people would say, well, on the question of eternal life, we are told. The classic John 3:16, whoever believes in me shall not perish but have eternal life, suggests that, well, if you don't believe in him, you will perish and you won't have eternal. Do you know what I mean? Like there are scriptures here. Jesus taught plenty about hell. It's not like the subject isn't contained in the scriptures. And of course, it is down to how you interpret it. But it's not hard to read the scriptures and come to the conclusion that actually hell is real and some people will go there.
You can read it that way. I mean, one of the things I like about Calvin is he says we are given things to see, to experience that are real and full of God's intention. We are not given descriptions of a world that does not yet for us exist. So God has directed our attention to certain things by making them accessible to our knowledge. So pay your attention there. I think that that's very wise, because people tend to go a little haywire when there is not tangible reality to push them back into sort of a clearer view of things. And frankly, I mean, the whole idea of judgment, which I believe in, nevertheless is used so viciously in Christian history, that I think it's, tip one's hat to it as one passes by, but basically it's not our business, As far as John 3:16, it's if you say, everyone who's 18 years old can vote, that doesn't mean that people who are blind cannot vote. You know what I mean? It's an appropriate description of people in a certain category. When, the rich young ruler, I think he's normally called, comes to Jesus and says, how can I have eternal life? Jesus says, you know the commandments. And then he ticks them off, He obviously is not excluding him on the basis of his very conspicuous, pious Judaism, So, I mean, I think that the fact that you can assure something to one category of people doesn't mean that you have denied it to other categories of people.
Have you ever doubted your faith?
When I was, about in high school, and my brother was in college, and he came home with Thus Spake Zarathustra and all the rest of it. And I read everything that my brother brought home from college, and I felt that for a while. I could see the logic of it and all that sort of thing, which is not real logic, but it was persuasive at the time. And it was like the lights went out. That version of reality was intolerable to me. It was like the ceiling came down, it was so, I mean, speaking from, it was so not descriptive. There was absolutely so much it did not contain, and so it didn't last very long for me. I had a crisis of non-faith.
It's been said before that faith and doubt are two sides of the same coin. And when people say that, they tend to imply that it's not just as simple as, I believe, because actually, there's something more fluid about faith. And, you don't sort of stay 100% certain about everything all the time. How could you? But I have heard other people say, no, I've never seriously doubted the fundamentals that, there is a God and he loves me. So people have very different experiences of that question of doubt.
Yes, they do. And frankly, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about close reading of Genesis is that those people are all over the place. It's not as if God is making, baskets, put good people here, bad people there. People are living under his eye in all kinds of circumstances of belief and fear and all the rest of it. And I think that one of the things that I think is very true and interesting when you read that closely is how individual people are. Those are real characters. I mean, you really feel Joseph. It's like you knew that man, And I think that from God's point of view, an enormous amount of the richness of creation is our individuality. He does not intrude on it, And on that basis, I think that we can't, you know, I mean, I myself think that most people probably do doubt what they believe, you know, in a sleepless midnight, you know. That's part of it. It's the life of it.
One of the things you've been praised for is your ability to put things into words as a novelist that other people will find hard to describe. And I think just earlier in our conversation about heaven and hell, you sort of mentioned how we don't know some of these things. So if I could put a slightly impossible question to you as a novelist and someone who has a way with words, do you ever think about the end of your life and what happens at that moment, which I'm sure we can all agree is to a large extent unknown? Scripture might give us one or two hints, and whatever it is must be very hard to put into words. But have you ever attempted to think, well, what does happen at that moment?
Well, you know, I mean, I just, you know, when you look at the world, you know, and the arbitrary features of the world, you know, liquid water and all this, you know, certain kind of atmosphere, certain kind of, and people, you know, with this multitude of languages and all the rest of it, you know. And I think if there is no conceivable circumstance in which I would be able to imagine any of these things, if I did not know them and see them, you know. And I have to assume by extension that the world that I have not known and seen, I can't imagine either. And I'm content with that. It would, let us say, it is not characteristic of God to create any kind of reality that is at the level of my comprehension.
Yeah, it's a really profound thing to think about, isn't it?
It is, it is.
So wanted to talk a little bit about one of your friends, Barack Obama, President Barack Obama. How did you first get connected with him?
Well, you know, he's a reader. He read he read Gilead and thought well of it. And so, you know, one day I opened my email and it says, invite from POTUS. You know, and I get 1,000 emails a day with the political things. And they said, call such and such number. And so I thought, you know, that could actually be something. And so I gave the number to my assistant, and she gave it to a friend of hers who's very good at these things. And it did indeed come from the White House. So I emailed back and I said I would be very happy to attend. It was an invitation to a dinner. And they wrote back and said, that dinner is closed. And then about 10 minutes later, I got another email saying, come, you know, he wants to meet you, you know. And so I went to Washington and we had dinner. It was lovely, you know, you can imagine, lovely small party of people. And then as I was leaving, he said, I would like to correspond with you. And so he said, you can write letters in any form you like, but I like handwritten letters, you know, they come by mail. And so I started writing to him and he started writing to me, and we had a pretty, pretty vigorous correspondence for a while. Then he left the office. It's such a strange thing, you know, but I, you know, just reading the news every day, I sort of knew what was on his mind, you know, and it was kind of possible for me to address that, you know. But when he left the office, I lost my imagination for his life and I stopped writing. And I think that we're probably going to see each other pretty soon. There are things in the works, but I cannot express what an honor it was to, you know, to have a friendship with him, and how consistently he has always drawn positive attention to me when it is relevant, when it's possible, you know. A wonderful man.
I imagine, I don't know if you ever did this, but if you were at the beginning of your career and writing out a list of things you'd like to achieve, I imagine, you know, receiving an email invitation from the sitting president of the United States to just come and have dinner. I mean, if it were me, it wouldn't even cross my mind. It wouldn't even cross my mind that could ever be a possibility. So was there a bit of a pinch yourself moment of what is going on here?
Well, I went there to find out what was going on, frankly. But you know, he has a very charming and distinctive reputation for kindness, you know. I felt secure that the experience would be, you know, positive, very positive.
But do you have any goals, you know, when it comes to your writing? You know, how concerned are you with how many, for example, how many copies of Reading Genesis will I sell? Is that important to you? How do you kind of measure the impact you're having, and how much does that cross your mind?
Well, you know, I have no idea how much or how little any of my books sell. My publisher just
genuinely,
doesn't,
you genuinely don't know.
I don't know. The publisher would be the one to tell me, but he doesn't, and I never ask. I'm perfectly content. You know, I can pay my bills. Everything's okay. You know, you do what you can. You put the note in the bottle and drop it in the sea. You know. But my books have done well for me, and more perhaps than I or anyone else would have expected.
Do you ever think much about legacy and how you'd like to be remembered?
I think about how I might be remembered. I don't draw on personal biography, and I don't like it. I don't believe it when I read it, when it's about other people, you know. If I could just vanish from the world, you know, but, you know, you jump in a volcano and that's just tempting people to write your biography. So it's one of those things I can't worry about. It out of my hands.
What do you mean by you don't believe biography?
I just don't. I have seen certain things that people have written about me, and never ever do I have a moment of recognition of this as myself.
I mean, I used one earlier in this conversation. I said that The Atlantic had described you as one of the greatest living Christian novelists. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about? You hear that, you just think, that's not me.
No, but I don't consider that biographical. I consider that critical. In any case, you know.
I mean, there's biographical details like where you were born and the names of your children. I mean, that's true, isn't it? So it's not that all biography about you is wrong.
It isn't. I mean, insofar as it can be factually, you know, affirmed, it is not wrong. Mm. But it's like with a character, you know, you can know all kinds of facts about him or her, you know, where he, she went to college and what city they're living in and what particular strife they are engaged by. But if it isn't imagined as a human self, these are simply irritating pieces of information, you know. And I think the same is true of, you know, I mean, I can imagine 50 different Marilyn Robinsons fitting themselves into my skeletal biography, you know, every one of them more irritating than the last.
That's a very interesting idea. Are you saying that, I guess, all of us as individuals are complicated and well-rounded individuals, that when people come along and try and write a biography, it very rarely gives a full sense of the person? Is that what you're saying?
An accurate sense, I think, you know. You know, you read a biography of a poet or someone and you think this has no, it's, you know, usually some Freudian thing happened in the remote past or something like that. That's not what it feels like or to write poetry. Even I, who have written so much bad poetry, can, you know better than that. But all of it destroyed. I don't want to pique anyone's curiosity. It's just, you know, it's like music, you know, you hear a great composer, you hear somebody else doing something of the same genre with the same instrumentation and so on. utterly different music, you know. People are like that. And if they don't get the sense of you, that, you know, it's just not you.
Well, that leads me to ask you, have you ever thought about writing an autobiography?
No. I don't believe myself any more than I believe anybody else.
So the problem isn't the people writing the biography. The problem is just the attempt at doing something like that.
Exactly. That's so little we know.
Well, I hope I have, in the limited time available to me, perhaps just even slightly began to scratch the surface in sharing with our audience a little bit of who Marilyn Robinson is, but I would not dare to go any further than that. And maybe I've said too much already, but Marilyn Robinson, it's been a pleasure.
Been a pleasure for me also.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.